Well, in the dark days leading up to World War II and during World War II, an English author who had experienced the horrors of World War I firsthand wrote about this increasing menace and talked with wonder about this mystical land of the West. His name was J.R.R. Tolkien, and he always referred to the West and how the reforged sword Andúril was the flame of the West. And I'm here to talk about the flame of the West today. Hi, everybody. I'm here with Steve Green and Scott Ott. And gentlemen, I want to talk to you as a cover, sort of as an introduction to a much deeper topic, about a company called Andúril. Andúril is the name of the sword that was reforged from Narsil. It is the sword that Aragorn wields at the end of Lord of the Rings. It is literally translated as the flame of the West, Andúril. Andúril is what I will generously call a mom-and-pop defense organization. One of the many products that Andúril makes is what you're seeing right here. You can tell it's about a little box about the size of a simple corner mailbox. If it detects an aerial vehicle entering your airspace, whether it be a drone or an enemy aircraft, it activates and the lid comes up, and up comes this missile called the Roadrunner. The Roadrunner then flies out of this box autonomously, goes on an intercept course, and will destroy either the drone or the incoming aircraft. And that would be pretty cool, you have to admit. But what's even cooler is if for some reason it either misses or decides that you want to call the mission off, Roadrunner will fly back to its box, deploy its landing gear, land, and be ready to be refueled and reused again. They have an undersea vehicle that looks like a torpedo. It's an autonomous marine vehicle that goes out and gets all kinds of reconnaissance information. They have an extremely high-speed, fully automated drone that goes flying around. They have helicopters that come out of boxes and fly around and do surveillance and shoot down drones and all the rest of this stuff. And this is a simple startup company. And guys, here's why I'm so fascinated by this. One of the things that we've seen in Ukraine is that warfare has become very, very different, become asymmetrical, where a $200-$300 drone can take out a $4-5 million tank without too much trouble now. It's entirely possible that companies like Boeing and Lockheed and Northrop could build machines like this, but they haven't. There's still places for Boeing and Lockheed and Northrop, obviously. You know, I don't think Andúril at the present time is going to be creating the next generation air dominance fighter. But the fact of the matter is that a number of engineers got together and built this company that does these defense products. But that's not what I'm interested in. What I'm interested in when we talk about the flame of the West is the idea that you can start a company that can do technological miracles. We did two shows in the not too distant past about privately funded lunar landers, where American companies, just a bunch of guys in, you know, bad haircuts, getting together and putting things on the moon. Steve, the out of the box coolness of these defense systems, and when I say out of the box, I mean literally out of the box, because this thing comes out of the box. But all of their solutions are very simple. They've got a device that fits on the back of a Jeep, just a regular Humvee, and it just launches drones that fly out and go and attack targets. It doesn't have to be attached to an F-35. This kind of innovation is critical for the next era of defense, which we are only now beginning to understand is not going to look like what we thought it was going to look like. It's not going to be fleets of bombers attacking heavy armor moving across the plains. We're going to be dealing with anti-drone weaponry. We're going to be dealing with devices that are sometimes the size of a hummingbird that can fly into buildings, do reconnaissance. And the fact that an American company can start up and do this, and not just Andúril, by the way, I don't see this happening anywhere else in the world.
Wow, yeah, a lot to chew on here. So I'm hoping this analogy only goes as far as it does, but in a way, the war in Ukraine is a lot like the Spanish Civil War of the 1930s. It's a preview of emerging military technologies.
That's right. That's right.
And we have seen, and the reason why I hope the analogy only goes that far is that the Spanish Civil War was also a preview of World War II, and I do not want the Ukraine War to blossom into a preview of World War III. That would be bad for everybody. But what we've seen is a much smaller, much poorer country has effectively neutralized in many ways the Russian Air Force. Certainly the Russian Air Force we were familiar with before the war started, which was, you know, super fast, long range precision SU-34s, which is maybe the best, well, maybe tied with the F-15EX Eagle II. But the SU-34 in its day was probably the best fourth generation fighter bomber in existence. Just a superb thing. And it's been reduced to lobbing dumb bombs from a great distance and then scooting back to Mother Russia because modern
Because some guy's got a box on his shoulder.
Exactly. And so we're entering this period now where things are very bifurcated. You're still going to have the gold-plated systems fighting for dominance of the airspace and increasingly of outer space, orbital space at the very least. That's where your gold-plated contractors like you mentioned, Northrop, Boeing, and I hope
Lockheed,
Boeing, and Lockheed Martin come in. But closer to the ground, militaries, even with all this cheap drone technology, militaries are so expensive that we've gone from trench warfare in World War One, where men were basically fighting shoulder to shoulder from the Swiss border all the way up to the English Channel, to fighting in trenches that are widely dispersed. You can barely see your next guy over. There's just far fewer boots on the ground because it is so expensive to keep everybody armed, and especially to keep them armed. Ammunition, all the rest, is all very expensive. And so everything is widely dispersed. And this is where these cheap weapons come in. And so, again, in the airspace, in orbital space, high-tech, gold-plated, jillion-dollar weapon systems, closer to the ground, it's going to be widely dispersed groups of men fighting with comparatively inexpensive, highly automated, AI-enabled drones and counter drones. This idea of a anti-drone missile system in a box is brilliant, and it might even be the slightly higher tech version of something that I saw. I haven't seen the details yet. I haven't gotten past the headlines, but my favorite mil blogger, Commander Salamander. That's his blogger name. He has to be anonymous because he's a naval officer, a retired naval officer. He suggested years ago that the way to counter drones was basically with shotguns instead of missiles. Because
that worked just great. Shotguns worked just great.
And sure enough, Ukraine and I believe Russia too are working on shotgun-based anti-drone systems. So we're talking about old technology. How long have shotguns been around? Long time. Enabled, made more lethal, made more effective with the inclusion of a little more technology. So it's fascinating to watch. I'm just sorry that in the meantime, all these people have to die.
Yeah. Well, Scott, I want to kind of get away from the defense aspect of it, although that certainly is the lead in here. Because to me, the flame of the West is not the sword.
Yeah.
The flame of the West is the idea. I recall many years ago, I went to see, there's a prop house here in Los Angeles, and had a lot of space props, and they had which had been seen in many movies, they had a perfect one-to-one reproduction of the space shuttle cockpit. So I went just to see that and sit in it. It was cool, and all the lights lit up, and everything was great. And as I was walking out of the building, it was just one of these industrial parks. You see them everywhere. They're just everywhere, these long, wide, low, flat buildings, and God knows what they manufacture in there. And as I was walking out the door, I walked past a small room. It was a tiny little place. It's two rooms that they'd rented in this industrial park. And I saw these beautifully machined things, and the guys were right there. I said, I'm sorry to interrupt, but my God, that is some beautifully anodized, you know, aluminum parts and stuff. And I said, would you mind me asking what you're doing? He says, yeah, we build rebreathers.
Oh. Hmm.
We build rebreathers just for recreational purposes. So you don't have to have a scuba tank. You can go out basically and just carry your own oxygen, and we scrub the CO2 out, and that's basically all we do. And these things are magnificently made. They're just beautifully engineered. And the thing that I keep coming back to, Scott, is that I don't see this happening elsewhere. You can occasionally see a Swiss company that will do something cool or maybe a French company or something. But this entrepreneurial, cutting-edge, bleeding-edge two guys with, you know, $100,000 in seed money and an idea. This is the flame of the West.
You know, as you were talking, I jotted a note to myself and I said, I think part of it is what I'll call the tinkering spirit. There is just a desire among at least people I knew growing up that it was never enough to just take something you bought from the store. You always thought you could make it better.
Opening the hood on your car and putting a new carburetor.
So, you know, when the kid at school who was with me in the Rocket Club in fifth grade got the Estes rocket that had a plastic tube in it that, you know, they pictured you putting a grasshopper in it. He was like, well, what would happen if you put an egg in it? And so, and he found out it didn't fly well with an egg in it. It actually flew horizontally instead of vertically. But he had to know. So he had to put that egg in there. And then now we're meeting this tinkering spirit, which, you know, goes way back to before Estes Rocket kids like me meets the maker revolution. And so now we have 3D printers and laser cutting tools and stuff like that are relatively cheap. We have augmented reality headsets that we can, and we have the ability from right where I'm sitting right now to learn any number of coding languages so that I could create things or to use tools like you've used, Bill, to make very rich kind of 3D looking animated graphics that look almost like real humans. I think of when I saw a show around the 4th of July where they had something like 1,000 lighted drones dancing to music and forming images in the sky, three-dimensional images of people doing things and animals and stuff like this. And I was like, holy cow, all those drones are flying in perfect synchronicity and their light colors are changing exactly when they need to because somebody wanted to make something pretty happen in the sky. Beautiful. For 15 or 20 minutes. You know, and that was the whole show, and people came, and thousands of people came to watch this thing happen. And so it gets to that level of detail and artistic expression, and then finally, I'll finish with this. I've watched, as you guys know, probably 200 or more launches and recoveries of the SpaceX rockets, and to this day, the most beautiful part of the equipment that I see there is not the rocket itself or even the coolness of landing a rocket ship on a floating barge out in the ocean. The thing that captivates me are the grid fins on the booster and the shape of them and just the beauty of that structure. And then I found out recently that those things are huge. They're like the size of...
I thought they were like this big. They're like bigger than men. They're gigantic.
They're car-sized. You know, they're these big things. And they're just exquisitely shaped and carved and curled. And the way they are manipulated by these little servo motors or whatever it is that they use.
Supersonic airflow,
It's just magnificent. And I think... I don't know if this is strictly an American phenomenon because I don't get out much, but I do think that there is something in the human spirit that says, let me see if I can make that a little bit better. Let me see if I can play around with that a little bit. Let me see if I can tinker with that. And then when you add the motivation of being able to then create multiples of this that you can sell to people and possibly become wealthy, that's great too. But I heard a quote today where they were talking about interviewing people and saying, what's important to you when it comes to the compensation that you get from your company? And one guy who was in a very high position making a lot of money, his answer was, look, if you paid me nothing, I would still do this. Because the money's great. I'm glad for the money, but I want to see what would happen if we did this. And so I'm going to do it anyway, whether you pay me to do it or not. And it's that kind of spirit, I think, that that can create so much good in the world, in addition to perhaps shutting down some of the tools of our enemies.
Just based off of what you just closed with, was my great pleasure to be close to a company up in Palmdale called X-Corp. They made rocket engines. They're no longer a business, sadly. But I was there for a number of days, and on one of those days, they announced that they had the money to make payroll, and one of the guys says, good, I can get a half a tank of gas for my Corolla. Mm. Now, this is a rocket.
Yeah.
This is a rocket scientist. And I spoke to Jeff Grayson, who was the president of the company, about that. And I said, the people you have working here for you, they're taking a big pay cut, right? He said, many of them are working for 10% of what they could make at Boeing or Lockheed. So why are they doing it? He says, because here, they get to build the stuff that they're designing. If they work at Lockheed, they're going to spend their career designing a pump for an airplane that may never, ever be built. They'll never get to see it. Here, we put the pump on the rocket. We fly the rocket in the morning. We get the test data in the afternoon. We start making modifications at night. That's what engineers want to do.
Yeah.
I am not for a minute trying to gloss over the appalling falling standards of education in this country and the shocking decline in our educational standards and abilities here in America. It is a potential catastrophe. But it's things like Anduril and companies like Anduril that make me not fear China or Russia, not only as a military power, but as an economic power. China turns out, graduates more engineers in a year than we graduate college students, and I'm sure every one of them are superbly well-educated, and that is a genuine national security threat.
Yep.
But when I was writing a series of screenplays 10, 15 years ago about a near future war in space, I had this one small company, it was quite a bit like Anduril, decided that they were going to go to war against China in space. And they said, you can't go to war against China in space because there's only 200 of us and there's a billion Chinese. And the response to that was, yeah, but how many of them are up there?
Yeah.
200 of them. And our 200 are better than their 200. This is the flame of the West. This is what China cannot have. China can never have an entrepreneurial spirit in a culture that is that homogenous. It's not even a question of the Chinese Communist Party. It's a question of homogeneity. All of the turmoils that make America such a turbulent place and make it so difficult for us on a daily basis to watch all of this stuff going on, this is what creates the flame of the West. It is a reactor. Mm. And the reactor is powered by disagreement. And the reactor is only maintained by a love of country and a love of the idea of America on a political level and on a technical level and on a personal level and a spiritual level. It's okay to disagree. As I was coming into the studio this morning, I thought, you know, if there were to be some sort of crisis like 9/11 or something, and I was the president of the United States and I had to give an address, I would say, and now I want to say one quick word about national unity. We should be deathly afraid of this idea of national unity, especially now. Now is the time for discussion. Now is the time for heated discussion, because without heated discussion, we're going to make errors, and we can't afford to make any errors right now. Everybody has an opinion on how to solve this problem, and we're going to listen to all those opinions, and we will come up with a solution. But this idea of us all immediately getting on the same bandwagon and going in the same direction is dangerous, and we've seen many times how that natural inclination leads us astray. The unity that we're looking for is the unity of honest disagreement.
Yeah.
Honest disagreement. That is the kind of society that's never existed before on the face of the earth. That is the kind of society that J.R.R. Tolkien was writing to not only defend but also to inspire. And I think that these guys who have been thinking so far outside the box in terms of defending this country could not have picked a better name if they'd spent 100 years than Anduril, the flame of the West, reforged from the shards of Narsil, a company that is basically taking a big set of broken, giant, old swords and wielding them together in a new, lighter, faster, stronger, tougher, cheaper, cleaner, better systems. And I'm just damn proud to be part of the same country that they are and fly the same flag over my house that they fly over their office. For Steve Green and Scott Ott, I'm Bill Whittle. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time here on Right Angle.